This Washington Post Live podcast is sponsored by Mozilla. Mozilla is proof you don't have to choose between integrity and innovation. Join Mozilla in their mission to reclaim the internet.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
It's my delight. I'm Bina Venkatraman. I am the Post columnist covering the future and innovations transforming the world. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the stage this morning Dr. Stephanie Tompkins, Director of DARPA. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, this is going to be fun. I want to start with how you kind of view our moment of technological change and innovation. The former CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, was recently interviewed by Time and said that he sees the current pace of innovation as outstripping by orders of magnitude the innovation he's seen in his lifetime. You've been around the block for a long time yourself and driving technological change. Do you agree with that, or do you think it's a bit of hype? Are we just in another chapter of the digital revolution? Where are we?
You know, I'm not sure if the story is fully written yet. In fact, I know it's not written yet. So we might have a different answer as we look back at different points in the future. But right now, it absolutely feels like things are accelerating. And it's for a variety of reasons, right? Some of that is simply because you have a whole planet full of people with a lot of technology that has been democratized and made available at many different levels. So innovation is happening everywhere, not just in large government labs, but also with things like artificial intelligence and robotics, the ability to just do research and science is moving much more quickly as well. What the impact of that is, you know, we'll find out.
Has that pace of breakthrough with AI surprised you? Were you expecting it?
You know, it's a good question. DARPA has been engaged in AI since the very, very beginning. And if you'd asked me a few years ago, let me take a step back and say the technology itself, not that surprised, but I think the implications of the technology on society and how quickly it's spreading and where it's sort of being used and where it can be used, that has an element of surprise that I don't think we had prepared ourselves for.
So Vineet reminded us that DARPA is the agency that we can thank and the US taxpayer money behind it for such innovations as just the internet, foundational parts of GPS. Obviously, over the decades, DARPA has invested a fair amount in machine learning. And precedent or history of investing in innovation is impressive. And I think people are wondering, from your vantage point, what is going to be that next generation of breakthrough? What are you working on now that is going to transform society in the future?
That's a fun question, and I'm going to have to narrow it down, right? So just for context for everybody, you know, DARPA starts about 50 new technology programs every year. Obviously, not all of them pan out, and so we're constantly pruning and you know, gardening those different programs, and we work across all disciplines. Certainly, there are things going on in microelectronics and in computer science that I think are part of a really broad cultural conversation right now. Maybe one of the areas that we're most intrigued by because of the applications everywhere is going to be synthetic biology and its use, not just in the obvious areas like medicine, but also in sort of everywhere, right? So biological materials, concrete, ways of generating food and materials wherever you need them, things like that. So we've got things going on, particularly depending on biology, where you're going to be able to make what you need where you actually need it.
By growing cells or growing biological organisms that would replace materials?
Or no, by using the biological organisms themselves as the factory to create the things that you want. So we have a program that actually uses water and air and then microbes to pull molecules together to actually generate food.
Really fascinating. Yeah. What kind of food?
According to my program manager, very tasty food.
Oh, okay. It's not like Impossible Burger. Sorry for anyone who loves it.
Yeah. Some of our previous programs focused only on nutrition, and we realized as we were working with some of the military service members who might have to eat this that we should think about flavor as well.
Yes, please think of the troops and the rest of us when it comes. So I know we have a clip to show of one of the areas where DARPA is working on technology that is for the military and for our returning troops, but also could potentially be transformative for the world. So I'm wondering if we can show that clip and if you can tell us what we're looking at. This is your advanced prosthetics work.
Oh, absolutely. So a number of years ago, DARPA postulated a really interesting question, which is whether or not you could fundamentally change the state of the art in prosthetics. You know, one of the great blessings of advancements in medicine is that many, many fewer troops were dying on the battlefield, but a lot of them were coming back with really debilitating injuries. And we had a DARPA program manager, these are the people who conceive and create our programs, who was an Army medical doctor, and he threw out a challenge. He said, if you lost your arm, if you could play the piano before you lost your arm, I want you to be able to play the piano afterwards. And that call to arms brought together neuroscientists and roboticists and sensor people. And through a series of challenges, we've gotten to a point where you actually have that, the technology now exists to have that type of capability, where people can feel with a robotic hand, and they have the dexterity and the range of motion that they need to be as they were before they lost.
Wow. Yeah. So in that clip at the end, I saw that the man is touching, I don't know if it's a partner's hand. So or is it right to think that he can actually feel
yes.
her hand?
Yes. Yeah. I will say, I mean, I'm kind of glad we don't have the audio. We would all be weeping and hunting for Kleenex boxes because they're feeling it. He's feeling it for the first time. It's his wife.
Wow. Well, that's moving. I hate to make a hard turn here, but I'm going to.
Okay.
When people think about DARPA these days, or at least often when I think about it, I'm a little worried about the idea of autonomous weapon systems and sort of runaway robots that could be out there, you know, so inflicting violence without our control. And I know that there's some amount of investment that DARPA is doing in, of course, creating those autonomous systems and has been creating and thinking about AI for military applications. How much of your work is focused on that, like ceding more control over to autonomous systems so we have less humans involved versus figuring out how we actually contain and control or get better outcomes from autonomous systems?
So I would actually say a huge part of what we think about is more on the latter half. So first one, our very starting point is always that it is about a partnership, and a partnership between machines and humans, not about replacement of humans, but maybe the shifting of you know, the balance of workload and the amount of attention that humans have to pay when they're being assaulted in all directions, you know, by too many things. Two, we have a philosophy when we are dealing with new technology of really trying to build in from the very beginning, thinking about the ethical, the legal, and the societal implications of the technology if we are successful. And we work very closely with ethicists and legal scholars and behavioral scientists to help us project and predict what kinds of things could happen so that in the course of any technology development, we are also trying to gather the data that, you know, policymakers would need to understand in order to inform on how it could be used, what kinds of regulations would need to be put into place. It's not perfect, right? You can never imagine everything, but it is our job to try.
So I understand you have the first ethicist, a scholar in residence at DARPA, who's working on these issues of what's the social implication of this tech before we roll it out. How does that work exactly, and how? Tell me how it works in relationship to the private sector, because we see companies rolling out technology now, you know, even if we assume the best of intentions without necessarily thinking about those societal implications down the road. So DARPA drives some degree of tech development. It doesn't drive all of it, right? Some of this is right. happening in Silicon Valley and elsewhere yeah. in the world.
So for context, in terms of like who drives what, I think when you imagine what happens in the commercial world, obviously there's a lot of money going into technology development, but it is always going to be aligned primarily with a business motive, right? You have to be able to make money. And then the kinds of things that DARPA and other government organizations tend to think about, we're often thinking about the problems that don't align in that space. So, you know, in the commercial world, if something goes wrong with AI and you make a bad recommendation for a movie to watch, the consequences are very low. If we make a bad recommendation on a battlefield, the consequences are tragic and really immense. And we often don't have, you know, vast amounts of consumer data. In fact, we never have vast amounts of consumer data to train on anyway. So we have to have fundamentally different ways of thinking about how to use and how to actually develop artificial intelligence and autonomous systems. But to your question about how our thought process flows out. I actually think that a lot of the commercial organizations are eager for solutions to some of the problems that they face. But they're in that tragedy of the commons where it's not the highest priority of any one organization. It is our highest priority. So if we do it and we have solutions that work, we expect that they would very quickly proliferate. And we are in constant conversations with a lot of the companies that are driving these. And they even partner with us on a number of things.
Do you have any examples of what you mean by working through these ethical and societal implications for technology? Can you share with us how you're doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. I brought up earlier synthetic biology, and so that's an area I think where everybody can sort of use their imagination and worry about what could go wrong if people aren't careful as you're editing genes and adapting microbes and things like that. So we had a program called Safe Genes a number of years ago, and it was looking at the development of something called gene drives. Gene drives are where if you make an adaptation, it doesn't work itself out through inheritance, like, you know, over generations of an organism. Anything that you add in might actually then sort of come back out again, right, through breeding and things like that. But gene drives are designed to be permanent, and we were really worried about the implications of that. So we had a program where we were focusing on how you would undo the effects of gene drives if things went wrong.
And this is things like when you release a swarm of mosquitoes that have been genetically engineered to perhaps not spread malaria, you're worried about maybe how that propagates in the population, and you want to be able to pull it back, just in case anyone didn't know what
gene drive was. Absolutely. Yeah. And so one of the things, so that program had an ethical, legal, societal implication. So I'm going to just use the term ELSI. Sorry, it's we love our acronyms, right? So we had an ELSI panel. Ethicists and biological scholars and folks who could really help all of the teams work through the thought process as they were developing technology and say, is this the direction we want to go in? Or if we do go in this direction, what kinds of things will we need to understand, again, from a regulation perspective? And a really fascinating thing happened within that team, within the teams that were working on the program, is they independently... with the advice of the scholars, they came together and came up with a code of ethics that they said that they would be willing to abide by, that they thought would be really, really important. And that kind of an independent code of ethics then forms a really natural baseline if you wanted to regulate a technology to say, instead of a clean sheet of paper and trying to impose things, we actually already understand the voice of the people who are doing this work. And there may be other considerations that you'd have to bring in, but it's an amazing starting point. And it was done by people who were deeply steeped in all aspects of the technology.
And are folks like the Gates Foundation and others who are working on gene drive technologies taking up any of that work?
So I believe so. I believe that it has very organically spread into a variety of different communities. I don't want to specifically put words in the mouth of any one organization.
Yeah. I want to ask you about China. So depending on who you talk to these days, China is either outpacing the U.S. in terms of its military investment in AI and its development and investment in biotechnology, or it's lagging way behind the U.S. in terms of LLMs and other forms of AI. How do you assess where we are relative to China in terms of investment in emerging technologies and whether there should be a cause for worry?
You know, I think like everything else, the answer is always going to be much, much more nuanced. And everybody wants to have an easy answer. We're behind, we're ahead. And it's never that simple. And even in something like AI, there are many, many different aspects of the technology. And there are some areas where they are working faster, and there are areas where we're working faster. Some of that comes down to priorities. As you know, for example, China has vast access to data about their citizens. That we choose not to collect, right? And so that means that we're going to go down different paths and work in different directions. So any moment in time, you probably need 100 different questions to like really try to assess the more subtle and nuanced level of who might be stronger in one area or another.
Do you think that data resource is going to be a driver of huge net gains in this the Chinese asset of data collection?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's an interesting thing that they have, and it's a resource that we don't work with, but we have other resources and we have other ways of thinking about technology. In some ways, it drives us to be more innovative and more creative in how to solve problems. while adhering fundamentally to our values about protecting privacy.
Say more about that, because I think, Vineet drew this line between the work that led to Siri that then led to the LLMs, but there are people who say that the LLM development and the fact that the U.S. kind of got there first, or U.S.-based companies got there first, says something about the U.S. model of innovation. Do you buy that?
I think a lot of things happening in our country say a lot about our model of innovation and in the very distributed model, and that ideas come from anywhere. They are not centrally driven and they are not centrally prioritized. That actually really reflects the DARPA model. We are an organization that is entirely bottoms up in terms of where the ideas come from. We bring in brilliant scientists and engineers from across the ecosystem and then tell them to change the world, and when they get comfortable, we kick them out, right? So we take that US model and we sort of accelerate it vastly. And so clearly we're believers in it. So accept the fact that I have a bias, but I do believe in that model, and I believe that the fact that amazing ideas and opportunities come from many, many different sectors across the country is a huge strength, and that's a strength that we should be playing to.
I am curious about whether you see that role changing. So government and government investment have been foundational to a lot of the technologies that have changed the world in the digital age, whether it's internet or the fact that Google came from NSF-funded scholars that became the founders of the company. But now I think there are some people questioning whether the government and the public sector are playing that same level of role. Are they investing in a sufficient level to be key players in innovation? Has the private sector just completely outpaced the government role? What do you see as the role of government in the innovation ecosystem going forward as we see these huge technologies take hold?
So for government in general, I really do see the role of government is to focus on those kinds of problems that are not, they are going to be often longer term, and they are going to be the problems that industry won't concentrate on. And it's just like your question about China, right? It is very nuanced. There are things that industry is simply designed to do much better and much faster, and we are more than happy to let them do that. But there are problems they will never look at because it is not tied to sort of business models and profit motives that someone has to if we really want to make sure that we're solving technological problems, you know, broadly and in a way that actually advances society, not just into certain sectors of society. And then DARPA in particular, our role is to take the risks and to do the really big, crazy things that as soon as we have demonstrated something is possible, we get out of the way as quickly as possible, as quickly as we can to let others move forward with that technology. But in general, big risks, crazy risks, things that no one even imagines are possible are not aligned with the way industry typically thinks or works. And so I think it's an ecosystem. It always will be. The balance might shift a little bit, but I'm not seeing an end to the need for the kind of government investment that has happened all along.
Well, I'm told I only have time for one more question, but because this has been so fascinating, I'm going to cheat and ask it as a two-parter. And so the question is, what concerns you most when you think about technology and how it's transforming the future? And then what makes you the most optimistic when you think about technology and the future?
Oh, well, you know what? It's a two-part question, but I think it's probably it's a one-part answer. And that is
efficiency.
It is that, you know, with all of the technological advancements that are happening, it actually means that the pace of science itself and our ability to answer questions is moving much more quickly. And the scope that we can look at. So, you know, we've been talking about AI and large language models. You know, there are the ability to harness that to allow you to explore multiple research pathways much more quickly means that everything is moving faster. So huge risk of it being abused or things going wrong, but incredible upside opportunities to solve immense problems and to defend against those risks. So it's an exciting time. It's a fascinating time. And of course, everything that we're doing is really trying to focus on some of those risks and potentials for surprise that we want to guard against from a national security perspective.
This has been absolutely wonderful. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Stephanie Tompkins, Director of DARPA.
Thank you for having me.
The following segment was produced and paid for by a Washington Post Live event sponsor. The Washington Post newsroom was not involved in the production of this content.
I'm Kathleen Koch, a longtime Washington correspondent and best-selling author. You know, we have heard about just so many exciting advances this morning, haven't we? But you know, when it comes to AI, the trick really is to advance the promise, right, while reducing the peril. And of course, central to that, many believe, is openness and transparency. Well, here to help us dig into, you know, the AI policy debate is Linda Griffin. Linda is Vice President of Global Policy at the nonprofit Mozilla. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, and hello, everyone.
So let's go back to the web browser wars. Mm-hmm. Mozilla was really front and center in those. What did we learn from the browser wars and then the dawn really of social media that we can apply right now as we look at regulating AI?
Yeah, the lessons of history come up a lot, especially when we talk about the web. Let me quickly situate Mozilla in all of this. We're the nonprofit behind Firefox, is what we're, I suppose, most well known for. But our superpower is we're a product builder, we're a philanthropic organization, we're a community builder, we're researchers, we're venture funders in AI. So we're coming at AI from all these different angles. But in terms of the web and what we've learned, I think the first thing is, as these new technologies emerge, they affect our lives at scale. And it gets harder and harder for governments to intervene when you have a handful of walled garden companies who are purely for profit running that market. So the role of competition and market concentration is really important, and making sure that more companies from and on a more spread out basis can build the products that we want to use in these technologies. When we're thinking about social media, again, issues that are very relevant today, access to data, transparency, all these still apply to AI. But more and more, it gets harder and harder for governments to intervene, to think about what is the public good, what is the public counterpoint, how do we make sure that this vast new technology is doing the things we want to do to benefit more people.
So you've been talking a lot to regulators about this. So how have you seen these conversations with regulators change over the last 10 years?
It's interesting what hasn't changed. And we're still talking about privacy. Privacy is going to be the bedrock of how we govern and think about AI in many ways. We're still talking about liability, about misinformation and disinformation. These things still apply. But what we're really seeing with regulators is they understand this. They're really skilling up in the US and across the world. Their jobs are getting more complicated. AI brings in so many different sectors and technologies working together. We're seeing regulators more and more hire the people, the experts, to help them think about this, but also work with other regulators. So creating forums where information and data regulators can work with telecommunications and competition regulators and have conversations where they see overlap and who should intervene and who takes responsibility for that.
So are you saying there is, though, some overlap on these early concerns from the browser wars and the early days of social media that still apply today? I mean, should that raise red flags?
Yes, and I again, I'm speaking broadly about a lot of different regulatory bodies around the world, but definitely, and Mozilla works to try and advise and give technical guidance where it makes sense. And we're definitely seeing an awareness of this and a hunger to skill up, to learn. So it's really important for those of us working and thinking about AI more broadly, and that's just not the builders, that's the people who are affected by it, that civil society especially, to work with regulators and to share their insights and data.
So last week, the EU Parliament passed the world's first major set of rules governing the development of AI. How involved has Mozilla been in that process, working with regulators?
We've been, through the many years of debate on this, we've been involved. We think the approach to look, which is right for Europe, it's talking about the risks, it's thinking about what are the highest risks in terms of how AI might roll out, how do we, where should we intervene, and what are the rules and governance we should create around that. So we've been involved from the very beginning through all the technical negotiations as well, and also to help the Commission in Europe understand the role of open source software in all of this.
What do you think about what they came up with?
It's a good start, but we're at the very beginning of this journey. Europe has made a first step. They're well set up to do this. They have a lot of systems and institutions in place to look at this. So we're encouraged by their approach. Risk-based approach to regulation is what I think a lot of companies 10 years ago would have dreamt of. So it's come under a lot of criticism, but let's wait and see. Let's see how enforcement happens. Let's see some test cases, and let's learn and keep building on that.
I'm curious if you think it could work here. It was interesting. Let's talk about some of the earlier conversations here today. The vice president of OpenAI said governments already have a number of mechanisms to address AI problems. And Senator Young said he didn't really think that we needed new laws. Simply, we needed to adapt and apply existing regulations.
Governments have a lot of levers in terms of how they want to govern new technology. Sometimes it's legislation, and I think at Mozilla we've been very clear that we think a federal privacy legislation across the US would be fantastic, and we'd love to support that. But look at the executive order. That's comprehensive, it's broad, it's ambitious. There's a lot in there. You're looking at a lot of the government agencies like NTIA and NIST. They're really thinking about what they can do with their current powers to govern AI and to help with transparency and impact.
You know, I know ideally we do want to see trustworthiness, we want to see openness in AI development. So how important is open source research?
We spoke about this earlier on.
That's why I knew I'd say open AI. So open source research and technologies and achieving that.
Open source approaches and software have been the bedrock of internet development and the web for the past 25 years in terms of more companies being able to build, more people being able to share open science and research. And indeed, the technological advancements we see in AI today, it's all down to open approaches and open source software. So we think it's a crucial element in how we go forward. And it is remarkable. There hasn't been much mention today about the role of open source in AI. We're still trying to understand how it applies, but how it cannot be an essential element doesn't make any sense. This is how we create transparency, how we help people understand the data that goes into these models, how we're able to audit and think about safety, and how more businesses can build these tools themselves rather than rely on a handful of companies now dominating the market.
I mean, it creates collaboration.
Which is nice when we think about technology, right? That's a good thing.
So Mozilla released recently a trustworthy AI report. It looks at where progress has been made on that front and what remains to be done. What did you learn?
So we published our first trustworthy AI report in 2020 before it was cool. We were trying to map what's happening, what are the conversations around this, what are the different elements of society thinking, whether that's consumers, product builders, government. And we recently published an update, which is in very Mozilla fashion, it's very open source, right? We want feedback. We want to know what you think. We're trying to map and guide where we think these conversations are. What is the point of AI unless more people can benefit from it more broadly? What is the point of this technology if it's just in the hands of a handful of companies thinking about their bottom line? They do important and really interesting things with the technology. That's great, but we need more. We need the public counterpoint. So for us, trustworthy AI, it's about accountability, transparency, and having humans in the loop, thinking about people wanting to use these products and feeling safe and understanding that they have recourse if something goes wrong. It's essential that we have it, but it's easy to forget in the race that we're all having now to build the biggest companies with the biggest impact and win that race.
That was another something interesting, I think, that the vice president of OpenAI talked about when it came to elections. You know, of course, they would do the right thing because it's in their interest. But what will happen when it's not?
That's what we need to avoid. And of course, if you have walled gardens, for-profit companies, owning the space, they play an important role, but owning the space, and that's the current trajectory we're on, we need to think about an alternative reality. Think about libraries, public service broadcasting, roads. A lot of these really important facilities are free to use. We should have the same thinking when we think about AI as well.
Now, last year, Mozilla created $35 million venture fund for responsible tech. You launched an AI-focused startup, Mozilla.ai. Mozilla sponsored and participated in so many efforts around the world on safe and trustworthy AI. I mean, UK, France, Kenya, the US. Why the full court press? And why now?
We started this conversation talking about the lessons of history. So we've been around for 25 years campaigning on open source and making the internet a public benefit for all. So we're seeing a lot of the trends that we saw 25 years ago. And Mozilla's the type of organization, a lot of people who were there 25 years ago are still working at Mozilla. So we have a lot of that institutional memory. So we think what happened with the web 25 years ago is starting to happen again. And we do think we have a role to play in that. That's the point of Mozilla.
Now, if we're back here in a year having this conversation, what do you think will be different? Do you think that what you're pushing, the openness, the transparency, the open source, will that have won the day?
I'd like two things to be different. One is that we talk about open source automatically when we're talking about AI, and we understand the benefits and what we'd lose if we close the door on open. And the second is that we have a lot more civil society in the room who have got the experience from a global perspective on how this is right now impacting people's lives positively as well as negatively.
So you're an optimist?
Cautious optimist.
Okay.
A realist.
Linda Griffin, Vice President of Global Policy for the nonprofit and Mozilla, thank you so much for the fascinating discussion.
My pleasure.
Really
thank
appreciate
you,
it.
And now back to Washington Post Live.
Well, hello and welcome back to Washington Post Live. I'm Kat Zakreski, National Tech Policy Reporter here at The Washington Post. And I'm joined today by Anna Makanju. Anna, thank you so much for being with us here today to talk about OpenAI.
Thanks so much for having me.
And this is obviously one of the conversations people are most excited about today, but a little over a year ago, it was difficult for you to get meetings here in Washington, D.C. Obviously, that's not the case today. What has that transition been like for you?
So, you know, on the one hand, I understand I spent 8 years in government, so there are just never enough hours in a day, and sort of making room to really focus on something that isn't at the top of the priority list is very challenging. So in that sense, it's been really wonderful that this transition has happened, because I think we knew for a long time, and many people believed that this transition would happen, that AI would have a really significant impact. And the fact that actually policymakers still have some time before this technology really becomes more capable and more impactful to think about how to really create the policy infrastructure for success, I'm really glad that we actually have the time and the space to have it now.
And I want to ask you a little bit just about the mood within OpenAI right now. Obviously, Sam Altman has returned to the board. The report is out. What does it feel like in OpenAI right now? Has the dust settled?
We're very relieved, obviously, that this is all behind us and that we can just get back to doing what we love to do, which is this work towards building AGI that's going to benefit everyone. So I think everyone is just happy that they can focus on that and not continuously, you know, just deal with the churn that that situation created.
And obviously, this all comes at a very critical time for democracies around the world. We have more than half the world's population expected to vote in elections this year. Earlier this week, we saw the Secretary of State warn of a flood of disinformation and talk about how AI might exacerbate that. How is OpenAI preparing for this onslaught of elections?
So yeah, it's 4 billion people voting, and that is really unprecedented, and we're very, very cognizant of that. And obviously, it's one of the things that we really think about the most, to really, you know, ensure that our tools are not used to deceive people and to mislead people. And this is not, you know, this is like a whole of society issue. So that's why we have engaged with other companies in the space as well. As you may have seen in the Munich Security Conference, we announced the Tech Accord, where we're going to collaborate with social media companies and other companies that, generate AI content. Because there's, you know, the issue of generation of AI content and the issue of distribution, and they're quite different. So for us, we really focus on things like transparency. So for our visual tools, ensuring that there is something called C2PA, which is essentially like a digital passport attached to an image so that you can understand where it came from and whether it was AI generated. We have prohibitions against images that contain real people, including politicians, to just prevent the generation of this to begin with. We, of course, have lots of teams investigating abuse of our systems or circumvention of the use case guidelines that are intended to prevent this kind of work. So there are many teams at OpenAI working to ensure that these tools aren't used for election interference.
And I want to talk a little bit more about what that communication looks like with the social networks, because obviously Meta, Google, these are some of the biggest social networks. They're also some of your biggest competitors in artificial intelligence. And so if you're working to coordinate with them on these issues, what does that communication look like? What kind of relationships do you have to ensure, hey, if a deep fake of one of these politicians or related to the election is going viral right before people head to the polls, what will that communication look like?
So I think part of it is, and one of the things that these Munich Accords were meant to do, is to establish all of the channels and industry standards and alignment across the industry of how we deal with this. And, you know, our antitrust lawyers always remind us that these conversations are really focused explicitly on safety. But we have many touch points and, you know, really figuring out like the infrastructure for the entire ecosystem for how this should work. We have quite a few touch points now, but of course it is continuing and it should evolve as we understand how these tools are going to be actually used. But I think in general, one issue that we have is that we don't really have complete alignment on how each of us does this and what is actually the standard that we should all follow. And that's one of the biggest things that we're working on, is creating that alignment.
Do you think it's possible to get there given the competition in this industry?
I think so, because at the end of the day, this is something that is, you know, in the interest of all these companies. It is not in any of our interests for this technology to be leveraged in this way. And everyone is quite motivated, particularly because we now have lessons from prior elections and from prior years. And so in that sense, I think that we are in a much better place, because nobody's coming into this unprepared. And because we are coming into it with so many learnings from previous work to address this issue.
What role is the U.S. government playing in these preparations and in helping the companies coordinate on elections?
Well, one of the things that's really different is how much more collaborative the relationship is. As you saw me mention in that video, previously, there really wasn't as much engagement between the public sector and the private sector, and that's really changed. And also, of course, it's, I would say, probably the number one question and you know, discussion issue that arises in our conversation with policymakers. So they are very focused on this, and they're certainly going to be holding these companies, you know, us and the other companies in the space accountable.
We've seen some pullback, though, from that coordination because of some of the litigation from conservatives who argue that type of communication between tech and the government amounts to censorship. I mean, do you think that litigation is affecting preparations for this election at all?
Certainly, it's something that people are keeping in mind, but you've seen actually quite a few bipartisan efforts as well on this issue. There have not been bills passed, but certainly a number of bipartisan initiatives introduced, not just around AI companies, but also what should other players in the ecosystem do that campaigns should disclose if they have AI-generated content. This does remain a bipartisan area of concern. Certainly, we hear from both parties that this is something that they're very concerned about.
And I want to go back to, you mentioned your antitrust lawyers. Obviously, OpenAI has had its legal challenges pile up. You have a lot more lawyers now. You're facing an SEC probe. Questions about competition, an FTC probe, the probe in the European Commission over your relationship with Microsoft. Are you under siege?
Well, I think actually what this demonstrates is there is sometimes a sentiment that because this technology is new, we're totally unprepared and there are no ways to like really keep it under control. And I think that the dynamic you just described shows that there's quite a few, there are quite a few regulators that already do have the authority to take action against AI generated harms. Just because, you know, fraud includes AI doesn't make fraud legal. I think in some ways it should be reassuring that we, you know, the government has a number of mechanisms already to address any concerns they have with a company like ours.
And I guess, what would you say right now your relationship is like with US regulators particularly? I'm thinking the FTC, SEC that are looking into the company. Obviously, you've taken Capitol Hill by storm. We've seen Sam Altman testify there. We know there has been outreach to the White House, but what does that relationship look like right now with the FTC and SEC?
Well, we're, of course, doing everything we can to be really transparent and cooperate with regulators, because, you know, this is a new area, and we understand that all regulators are still trying to understand, you know, what is the full scope of their, their authority, and like what should they actually be doing vis-a-vis companies like ours. So again, I think our approach in general with policymakers is that we want to be collaborative, and we want to, you know, it is. Our mission is to make sure this technology benefits everyone, and a really healthy regulatory ecosystem is essential for that mission to succeed.
And obviously, you're in Washington today. I'm thrilled you're taking the time to be here with us at the Post, but I'm sure you have some other meetings on your calendar. Who else are you meeting with while you're in town?
You know, it's really amazing because I have this, you know, a year ago when we were going to meet with the Prime Minister of Japan, I was still scheduling my ordering my own van and, you know, online trying to find an interpreter and ordering our lunch. And now we actually have colleagues who can support. So I was actually just thinking that I don't know exactly because my schedule is probably still being done. But I'm definitely seeing, I think I'm seeing Representative Obernolte and Schiff. A few other colleagues in on the Hill and in the administration.
So some of the members of the House AI working group. And, you know, after our conversation, we're going to have two of the leading senators working on AI policy on stage. It's an election year. It's a big question what Congress can actually get done on AI. If Congress had to prioritize just one thing this year, what would you recommend they focus on?
For a technology that touches virtually every facet of life, this is extremely challenging. I mean, I think the key for us is, and I would say actually that these two senators have really been amazing leaders, particularly on, you know, they were critical to chips and science, which now we all see that the hardware aspect of AI is as critical as the software, and, you know, it will be critically important for the U.S. to ensure that they are, you know, well-positioned in that area as well. But really for us, it's critical that the regulation of this technology is driven by data and driven by science. And I think that that's why it's actually quite good that Congress has taken time to truly understand the technology before putting in place regulation, because that means that it's actually going to be resilient as this technology continues to evolve incredibly quickly.
And I want to come back to that issue of the hardware and chips. But first, I want to talk about some of the new technology that OpenAI is rolling out. At the video when we were coming on stage, they showed some of Sora. But can you tell us a little bit about this technology and what OpenAI's plans are for it?
For Sora in particular?
For Sora, yes.
You know, we do have this philosophy of iterative deployment, which means that when we are rolling out new technology, we really take as much time as necessary to make sure that all of the safeguards are in place, which means that one of the ways we do this is something called red teaming, which is inviting people in, a small group of people, to really understand what potential harms are there so that our technical teams can then take that back and understand what, and our safety teams, like what mitigations are necessary, what additional staffing might be necessary before rolling it out. So I don't have a specific timeline, but I do know that especially with technology like this, where it can have some really incredible, you know, applications, but also obviously could cause harm, that we are not going to move forward with broad public deployment until those safety mitigations are in place.
And we actually have a clip here that your team provided of how this technology works. And so this video was generated from the text prompt historical footage of California during the gold rush. And so I haven't had the opportunity to actually use Sora myself yet, because as you mentioned, this red teaming process is still ongoing. But to create a video like this, what types of data are you using to train the Sora model?
It's really a mix of data that is licensed and public, and we don't really go into details of what exactly is in the training data set. And you know, part of that is because we, unlike some other companies in the space, are not sitting on sort of decades of user data. So we're necessarily reliant on more data from the internet and more proprietary ways of collecting these data sets.
But isn't that kind of, you know, in opposition to your stated goal of transparency, especially as we're having these debates over who owns what content online and you're facing lawsuits like the one from the New York Times?
Yeah, I don't think so, because one, there is really, I think, a misunderstanding of what pre-training data does. So pre-training data isn't something that the model simply returns. It is something that the model uses to create an understanding of how the world works. So a single piece of data in the pre-training data set is really not going to be something. In fact, these models are very bad at being able to understand something from a single piece of data. This is partly why you need such massive data sets to train these models. So the relationship between any piece of training data and the output of the model or understanding the model is like very, very tenuous.
What is your message to filmmakers, video makers who might watch footage like that and be concerned about the impact this could have on their jobs?
Part of what we're using this period for, when you know we have this previews of Sora and before we make any plans to commercialize this, to engage with that community. And again, you know, this is also something that we want to work with the entire ecosystem on, is what, and by the way, we, you know, even I'm obviously not the person building Sora or determining who gets access, but I get daily emails from people in the industry asking for access so they can experiment and use it. So the hope is that it will really actually empower and give a new tool to people in this space. But I also recognize these concerns. That's why we want to engage with this community and really think about how we can bring them along with us as we think about plans for deployment.
And I want to talk more about that iterative deployment process and the red teaming that you laid out. I mean, we are in a massive election year, and obviously every year is an election year for OpenAI. You're constantly yeah. dealing with elections around the world. As someone responsible for global affairs, what would you need to see in the red teaming process so that you would feel it's safe to unleash this technology and it's not going to undermine democratic elections?
I mean, a key piece of it is the diversity of experts. So one thing that we really think about is who are the right people to bring in to test these tools, and particularly, you know, even think about unknown unknowns, right? We have a team called Preparedness is led by Alexander Madri, and they actually think about, like, okay, we may not know the exact capabilities of the models at the very frontier and the research that we're undertaking, but we want to have the safety be as robust and expansive as possible. So we are this team is constantly thinking about, like, given any new capability that might emerge, who needs to come in and help us, you know, really think through, like, what are the worst possible things? What are things we're not thinking about because we just don't have the internal expertise? Who do we bring in to look at this? And how do we make sure that this testing is as robust as possible? You saw them put out, an evaluation of the biorisk of the models that contained the biggest group of experts ever to engage on a biorisk evaluation, just so that we really get a sense, compared to what's out there already, what could, you know, someone who's really adversarial do with these tools?
So who are some of the experts then that you're bringing into Red Team Sora?
You know, this is a good question. I know that it's some people who are actually working with this kind of technology. I'm sure people who we've worked with to Red Team other models, but to be honest, I don't know the exact names of people.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit too, you know, you and I have talked over the last few months about your concern about how autocratic governments could potentially abuse OpenAI's technology. What are some of your biggest concerns when it comes to autocratic governments and these new video technologies like Sora?
Well, Sora is still a research preview. So part of what we're trying to understand is, you know, beyond disinformation concerns, what are some of the concerns? Obviously, we've seen some concerns of using it for scams. So that's one of the reasons that we, in general, in our visual technology, we work to ensure that you can't have images of real people. But, you know, the EU AI Act, one of the categories that it has is essentially unacceptable use cases, and such as social scoring. So these kinds of things are already being done, and, you know, there are jurisdictions that have decided this is not a use of this technology that will ever be acceptable.
And I want to shift back now to the issue of chips, which you brought up as we were talking about policies for lawmakers to consider. It's been reported that OpenAI is considering launching its own chips initiative, that this is an initiative that would require potentially trillions of dollars. And so that is, you know, money that we could only see from governments. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a benefit for OpenAI to not be dependent on other chip makers. But is it more risky for OpenAI to become more dependent then on government sources of funding?
So I think that this is not all of the pieces of this reporting are are accurate. First of all, it's not that trillions. I think the trillions of dollars number really talks about the entire ecosystem that's necessary for AI infrastructure and hardware, which includes energy and, you know, construction of data centers, et cetera, not really necessarily like chip production. And the idea is not that OpenAI, you know, itself is now entering into chip production, but that we really just need more capital in order to ensure that there is the entire ecosystem is getting the necessary hardware to do this. Right now, I think every single company is probably not getting the amount of chips that is needed, certainly to meet the demand that we see coming up very shortly, because right now, actually, a relatively small percentage of the population is engaging with these tools, and that's obviously going to explode. They're going to be integrated into so many other things that we use every day. And so the demand is really going to skyrocket, and it's not clear that the supply is, you know, going to meet it. That's why you've seen significant investments like the one that the Biden administration announced yesterday. But we have seen that the demand is probably even greater than can be fulfilled with that. So that's really the idea behind this initiative, especially, again, if we are saying that we want this technology to benefit everyone, and many people won't have access because they don't, they simply, there's not like the hardware to be able to use this technology, then many, you know, many communities are going to be left out.
And it's been reported that you're raising money from funds connected to the United Arab Emirates. What do your conversations with the Biden administration look like around raising foreign capital for this type of work?
It's not really just we are talking to lots of people to try to understand, you know, how who is positioned to make these kinds of investments. But we obviously always stay close to the U.S. government on this. And, the, you know, the U.S. government has made, you know, there was a $100 million investment between the U.S. and UAE in clean energy last year. So this is a government that is a critical ally of the United States as well.
Are you concerned about any of the, given your work, given the, your concerns about human rights issues, do you have concerns about the company developing these closer financial ties with the UAE and other governments in the Middle East?
So again, this isn't, you know, the discussions are not, you know, an OpenAI specific project. And I don't, again, I don't see this as dependent specifically on any one player, but as a conversation about where can the funding sources come from for additional hardware that won't be just for OpenAI, but will be for everyone who's developing these tools.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, so Anna, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today at Pulse Live.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.